Welcome everyone to the Adventure San Antonio Life Science Innovation Podcast. This is a podcast to showcase startup founders and innovators around Texas. My name is Tu, along with my co-host Luis.
Hello everyone. Okay, so Dr. Theodore Price is a professor in behavioral and brain sciences at UT Dallas. He is involved in local and state outreach programs. He is also a member, editor, and founding member of various national and international organizations and societies. He has received many outstanding awards for his research, which focuses on understanding the principles that underline pain plasticity to develop novel therapeutics for neuropathic pain. With the discoveries from his lab and in the field, he founded 4E Therapeutics that is dedicated to developing novel, non-opioid treatments for neuropathic pain.
Welcome, Dr. Price.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay, so first I would like to hear a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, I'm a neuroscientist and pharmacologist. I grew up in Dallas. I was born in Kansas City. My parents moved to Dallas when I was a little kid. I grew up here. I did undergraduate at UT Dallas in neuroscience. Then I moved to San Antonio, where I did a PhD in pharmacology. I left San Antonio in 2004, moved to McGill University in Montreal, where I was a postdoc working in the pain area. And then I took my first faculty position at University of Arizona in 2007 and moved back to Dallas in 2014 and have been in Dallas since then. I'm married, I have two kids, and quite enjoy being a professor at UT Dallas.
Oh, that's nice. How did you get into pain research?
I got into pain research because of two gentlemen at UTL Science Center San Antonio, Ken Hargreaves, who's still there and is the chair of the Department of Endodontics and also a professor in pharmacology and probably five or six other departments. And then also a guy named Chris Flores, who is no longer there. Chris left to join Johnson & Johnson when I was in my fourth year of doing my PhD. And he actually is still at Johnson & Johnson. He's very high up in the scientific side of the company now. And those two guys were my co-mentors for my PhD, and they really introduced me to pain research. I didn't come to San Antonio with the intention of doing pain research. I came down there with the intention of working on depression and anxiety. And I'm quite happy that I met them and was introduced to the field. And I really kind of fell in love with it because I think it presents a great opportunity to do really interesting basic neuroscience research and also great opportunity to have a dramatic impact on people that suffer from chronic pain by gaining a better mechanistic understanding of why chronic pain happens. And also developing drugs to treat chronic pain, which has become a major focus of what we do in my lab and in the companies that I'm involved in.
I see. So you have founded a few companies. Can you briefly talk about them?
Yeah, sure. So I've founded five companies now. The first one I founded, which actually became two companies, it was Circe Therapeutics and also Ted's Brain Science. Circe Therapeutics is the great hit so far of my life, I guess. That was a company that we started basically right after I got to Dallas. The founding group for that company was on the scientific side was myself, Greg Dussor, Lucas Rodriguez, who at the time was a PhD student in bioengineering, and a medicinal chemist named Scott Dax, who I actually met through Chris Flores, who was my PhD mentor. And we had some people on the business side also who played a big role in helping that company get going. And that company sold to Acadia Pharma, a big pharma company, this last year. And the details of that deal have been publicly disclosed, so I'd be happy to talk about them if you're interested. But, you know, it was a great deal for all of us. So I've now experienced going through founding all the way to exiting with one company. Ted's Brain Science is a company that has a topical therapeutic for pain on the market. That's been a rewarding experience because, you know, that this is like the closest I get to interacting with pain patients with a product that we've developed. We have lots of people that use our product and thoroughly enjoy it. Many of them email me about how happy they are with it. And, you know, it's not for everybody because it's a topical, but it does help a lot of people an awful lot. which is great. And then after the positive experience of those two companies, I guess I decided that this was fun and I'd keep doing it. And so 4E Therapeutics was the next one I started. That one is based in Austin. We're funded by NIH, and that's going really, really well. We're developing some new neuropathic pain therapeutics, and then started another company called Parmedics, where we're developing PAR2 antagonists for migraine. And then the most recent company that I founded is called Dolaromics, and that's a bioinformatics company in the pain space to discover new targets for many different types of pain.
Wow.
Right. That's impressive. So you did mention that your previous mentors, that I think you said Chris Flores,
yeah,
they're the ones who got you into thinking about starting up a venture. So how long did it take you from getting the idea of getting into startups and then actually beginning one?
Yeah, it took more than 10 years. The idea really started at a Society for Neuroscience meeting when Chris Flores, I was still a PhD student. Chris Flores had just left for Johnson & Johnson, and his compatriot there was Scott Dax on the chemistry side. And Scott and I hit it off right off the bat. And Scott really kind of planted the idea in my head about developing pain therapeutics. And at the time, you know, it was more about, you know, how interesting it was to work at Big Pharma. This was before 2008, when everything really changed with the Great Recession and many people were laid off, including Scott. So that's when Scott got laid off at Johnson & Johnson. And, you know, I guess about that time when I started my lab in Arizona is when I got really serious about thinking about what I could actually do. And then we tried to do this in Arizona with really no success. And I would say that was mostly because we didn't have connections to people on the business side that we really needed to get it going. And then when we came back to Texas, it was part of the intention of our recruitment was that we met with people that were on the business side that we could potentially work with to spin our companies out finally. And that led to me meeting Lucas Rodriguez, who was really the most important person in terms of making this happen that I've met in my life. And, you know, it's interesting because Lucas was a PhD student at the time. He was taking entrepreneurship classes at the university, and he just really understood how to do it. And he also had a passion for doing it. And we all just kind of said, all right, now's the time. We're going to dive in. And Lucas really led us on the business side. We brought in other people, obviously, that acted as mentors for him. So, you know, we were kind of mentoring Lucas on the scientific side, and he had other mentors on the business and business development side. But, you know, he was the engine that made it run. And I learned an enormous amount working with him. I'd like to think he learned a lot working with us too. Actually, I know that's true. We all learned a lot. And, you know, that's really what it was about. I needed somebody to work with that could help facilitate all of us learning about how to do this. And now I feel like I have a pretty good handle on how to actually do it. And it really is a lot of fun. And so I've become what I'm told by other people is a serial entrepreneur.
That's actually very amazing, because there are many scientists that do clinical and translational research, but only a few actually decided to commercialize their ideas.
Yeah, I wish more would decide to commercialize their ideas, because I really think that this is how we're going to get these great ideas into the hands of patients that need it. So, you know, in the pain space, I see my colleagues doing amazing work all over the place. There's many in San Antonio, Ken's lab in particular, also Armin Akopian, Nathan Jeske. There's a bunch of people there who have really terrific ideas. And I think there's a great opportunity for them to spin these out and companies and to try to take them towards the clinic. It doesn't always work, and it oftentimes doesn't work, even though the science is really good. You know, there's lots of things that can go wrong, but it's worth the effort. And ultimately, that's what we need to get really innovative therapeutics into the hands of patients.
Yes.
And I thought it was really interesting how with the idea of non-opioid painkillers, mm-hmm. It's kind of an epidemic still going on, and I guess in this country, mm-hmm. With opioid addiction. Would you say that was a kind of like a benefit to have, that was in people's interest to try to help relieve that problem?
I mean, we've definitely benefited from being at the right place and the right time, so to speak, in terms of non-opioid pain therapeutics. I mean, and the in the late 90s, I guess, maybe early 2000s, I think there was an idea that opioids could really be used to treat people over the long term for pain, but I don't think anybody really believes that anymore. There are some people that I think, unfortunately, are kind of stuck with opioids because they've been on them for so long, and it's probably not a good idea to take them off without some really serious medical care around doing that. But yeah, I mean, there's lots of funding from NIH to do this. All the companies I've been involved with, by the way, have had some kind of funding from NIH. In that respect, it's not different than running an academic lab. It's just, you know, there are different kind of grants that we're applying for. And the ends of the grants are a little bit different than a normal academic grant. So there's lots of programs available in that direction. And then there's a lot of people on the investment side that are interested in pain and are willing to put up some riskier money a little bit earlier on in the life of a company with the hopes that there'll be a big payoff down the line.
You mentioned receiving grants from the NIH. Can you elaborate more about funding opportunities for startup companies?
Yeah, well, let's start with the NIH grants. The NIH grants for small businesses are actually, they have higher success rates than R01s and R21s. So they're in theory easy to get, but no easier to get, but you know, no grant is actually easy to get. The process of writing them are very similar to an R01 or R21. It's just that, you know, what you're ultimately doing at the end of the day has to have some obvious commercialization purpose. So that, I think, is the main difference. It's not just purely basic science, even though it can involve basic science, but you really need to show how it's eventually going to potentially lead to a product. And, you know, some things are better done in an SBIR, STTR grant, you know, like product development work, pharmacokinetics and toxicology. It's probably easier to get money to do that within a business than it is in a normal academic NIH grant. Raising money from investors is not something that I have been the person actually doing, although I participated in it. And, you know, it's like anything else. You know, you have to understand who your audience is and you have to be very patient, not because, you know, dealing with them requires patience. It's just, you know, people in different walks of life are all really smart, but they're going to have different types of questions for you. And sometimes you'll be explaining things in a lot of detail that you think you shouldn't necessarily need to explain, but you need, you know, you just need to remember it's not, you're not talking to a scientist in this particular instance. In some cases, you're talking to a finance person, et cetera. And, you know, people need to understand what they're getting into before they put their money into it. And in our case with Circe, you know, I didn't go to all of the meetings we had with investors by any stretch of the imagination, but I went to several of them and it was a great experience. I mean, I learned a lot meeting those people. I've made connections with people that I'm really glad that I know now. And, you know, it's a different type of kind of educational activity, right? You're trying to help somebody understand something that they're not necessarily an expert in, but they really want to understand it well and they want to contribute to it. You know, and it's not always just about making money. Making money is one aspect of why they're making an investment, but they also want to make an investment because they want to see something succeed and they want it to make a difference in the world.
Yeah, that's actually very true.
Yeah, so it sounds like you have to learn a different type of communication from these investors. And there's like, I guess, a lot of things you got to put together, you know, not just the, you know, making money, mm-hmm. but also like making it understand, like effectively communicating what you're trying to do. And I guess, is there like people who are like naturally good at that, like who can communicate with them or kind of show that they have?
Yeah, I mean, there are definitely people that are naturally good at it. And, you know, Lucas is a good example. Scott Dax is too, actually. They come from different areas of basic science. Lucas is a bioengineer. Scott's a medicinal chemist. But they're both really talented in talking to people. So they were a great team. I think I'm pretty good at it too. And the way I learned how to do it, frankly, was by teaching. You know, I think that's something that a lot of people that are getting a PhD put a little too little emphasis on, you know, really working on being a good communicator. And being a good communicator on the fly is really important. And, you know, a lot of times PhD students and postdocs shy away from giving presentations. Mm. I think that's a really big mistake, actually. You know, I mean, anybody, even people that really don't like giving presentations, and I really don't like, when I started, I really did not like giving presentations, can become very good at it by practicing. It's like, you know, you can get better at anything if you practice. And I think that's a really important skill to try to acquire. And, you know, while you're doing a PhD or doing a postdoc, there's usually lots of opportunities to give presentations. And I think students are well served by taking advantage of them.
Yes. Mm. effective communication is very important, and learning how to communicate to different target audiences is just as important.
Yep.
I would like to know if you had any challenges in starting your own companies.
Yeah, we had lots of challenges. There's no question about that. I mean, we had funding challenges, we had scientific challenges, we had personnel challenges, and you know, relationships with people that you work with are a lot different when your money is involved. You know, I mean, collaborations with NIH grants can become tense for certain reasons, but it's not really the same type of tension as when you're a substantial amount of your own cash is involved in an entity. That just creates a whole another type of tension. And that was challenging. You know, I really had to learn what a business really is about. And then it's not the same as running my lab. You know, I think when I first started, I didn't keep those things as separate as I should have. And by that, I don't mean like intertwining the company with the lab. We never did that. And you never should. That's not a good idea. If the reason that you're starting your company is to try to fund your lab, you shouldn't do it. That's not the way that it works. Yeah. I needed to understand that what we did in the lab and what the way I dealt with people in the lab and the way that this would happen within the company were two completely different things. And it took me a while to really understand that.
Mm-hmm. And you did mention that there are some differences in managing a research lab and a company. I'd just mm-hmm. like you to expand a little more on the differences and as well as the similarities.
So, I mean, when I run my research lab, everything is driven by curiosity, you know, what did we just observe and what does it mean? You know, that's what we're always trying to think about. And that's the way that I run my interactions with students. And a company shouldn't really run that way, I don't think. That, you know, serves you really well in basic research before you have something that's commercializable. But once you're actually working on commercializing it, there are some things that you don't want to know, you know, that there's some things that you shouldn't spend resources on. It's just a completely different thing. It's not about curiosity. It's about a goal. And the goal should be getting what you're trying to develop into patients or, you know, more often than not, it's going to be to exit, you know, to sell your company. But even then, it's the same thing. You know, I mean, like in Circe, we knew from the very start that we didn't have what we needed to do phase 2 and phase 3 clinical trials. We had a really good team that was very appropriate for going from preclinical through the IND, the investigational new drug, to doing phase 1, potentially doing some phase 2, but we just didn't have the personnel and the expertise that's needed to run big phase 3 clinical trials. Big pharma is really, really good at that. And we knew that we would need to hand off the company to a big pharma group. And we wanted to find the right group that we could hand it off to. So we would, you know, we would feel like it would end up being successful at the end of the day. And we, I think after everything was said and done, we felt great about Acadia being the right group to take what we had done so far and hopefully turn it into a new treatment. Non-opioid treatment for chronic pain and acute pain for that matter.
How do you deal with like celebrating success? Do you wait till like the very end or do you celebrate like small successes along the way?
That's a great question. You know, COVID stole our celebration from us for Circe. I mean, we sold in August and that was awesome, but we couldn't get together. You know, there's like 20 or 30 people that were involved in this, more than that, you know, if you count some of the more passive investors. And yeah, I mean, it would have been great to have a celebration. We probably would have flown somewhere and had a big dinner with everybody's families, and that would have been amazing, but we can't do it. Maybe one day we will, but we didn't get the chance. I do try to, you know, with my lab, I try to celebrate small successes. And that comes in many different flavors, but you know,
did you get a bouncy house?
Yeah. No. I mean, so with the kids for birthdays, yes, definitely the bouncy house. I don't know. I would say, you know, what I try to do is to make sure that the people that work with me feel like I appreciate what they do on a daily basis. I also try to be a cheerleader as much as I can, because you know, being a PhD student, being a postdoc is hard. And I try to make sure people feel appreciated. So I guess that's how I try to celebrate success.
Mm-hmm. And celebrating small successes are really important because the journey is long and you just sometimes you just need a break or just a reminder on why you started the journey in the first place.
That's true.
I was just curious if there's any academic institution that is tied to your company specifically for e-therapeutics.
So we're tied to UTD. We licensed the technology from UTD. UTD will benefit from that. And then with Parmedics, we've licensed the technology from University of Arizona. And for Dolaromics, we plan to license the technology from UT Dallas.
I see. How involved are the academic institutions in running the companies?
The way that this works is that you have a license deal, and in some cases, the institution will get royalty payments that are set out in the initial licensing deal, and in others, they might get some equity or something like that. But the institution, in almost all cases, I think, doesn't become like the operating owner of the company. And in fact, most academic institutions are not capable of doing such a thing. So they're kind of passive equity holders and might play some role in helping the IP to get established and doing some other early things in the company, but for the most part, don't play any role once you're really kind of rolling down the line.
See.
So I think that's actually quite a bit different than most people think that it is.
Mm-hmm. What are your visions for the future of these companies that you're still working on?
For 4E Therapeutics and Parmedics, I definitely want to sell them. I mean, we're building to sell, and we're building to sell to Big Pharma. I hope that we would be able to offer them a product that would be extremely compelling and has a great chance for success in what they excel at, which is late-stage clinical trials. So our goal in both of those is to hand off a very efficacious and very safe molecule or package of molecules that we've demonstrated are safe in humans and maybe have demonstrated some proof of concept efficacy.
Mm-hmm.
For Dolaromics, I don't know. I mean, we're just getting started, and it's possible that we would go in a much different direction with this company because it's not built around a single therapeutic opportunity. It's more of a platform company. We're in the process of signing a deal with a large biotech to become part of their accelerator program, and that, I think, will open up lots of interesting opportunities for us, and we'll have to see where it goes while we're part of that program. So I'm pretty excited about that.
Yeah, that sounds exciting. You know, these companies, it's nice to sell them to bigger companies so they can develop that more, mm-hmm. but it's nice to have something of your own to keep working on, just like you mentioned with the last company.
Yeah, I agree. So we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, and it sounds like you're beginning more startups, and you've already done a few. Mm-hmm. So, like, it's something that it's kind of like riding a bike, that once you get into it, you kind of throw yourself into it, you start getting the feel for it. So do you feel like you've gained some skills, you know, with that whole process?
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely feel like I've learned enough that I kind of know what I'm doing now. And I would not want to be the person running the day-to-day business side, because, again, it's just not my strongest skill set. And I know that I still have lots of holes in terms of what needs to be done in that regard. Another big motivating factor for me in starting these companies, though, is because it creates really good jobs for the people that I work with that are doing their training. So, you know, Lucas ran Circe Therapeutics. He started as a PhD student. Jim Son, who's our vice president for drug development in 4E Therapeutics, he joined us after being a postdoc and research associate at University of Texas in Austin. And I worked with him a lot when he was still a postdoc in Steve Martin's lab down at UT. And then at Dolaromics, Candler Page, who's a PhD student with me, and Jackson Brower, who's another PhD student in our program here, they're the ones running that company. So creating jobs for the trainees that I've worked with is also a motivation for spinning technology out. These are good jobs. They're great opportunities. And I think it would be great if more PhD students looked at this as a career path, because I think it's a very viable one and also potentially quite lucrative one.
Yes. I was just going to comment that it's very important for PhD and postdocs to know that there are more opportunities for them out there. And it's great that you and your lab are providing that.
Thanks. I agree. It's a great opportunity. In some ways, I'm a little bit jealous that I'm not in the PhD stage, you know, where I could still do some entrepreneurship classes. And I mean, I could, I guess, but seem like I'm a little too old to be the one taken out and doing it now. I lack the energy to be a startup CEO.
So I know you don't do everything in all of the companies that you founded, but how do you balance being a professor, running a lab, and also running all these companies?
Yeah, so I don't do very much running these companies, honestly. You know, I mean, I play a big role when they get started. I stay involved because I'm very interested in what they do, but I also know that I'm not the business person and I shouldn't be running the day-to-day of them. I don't ever try to be the CEO. I don't tell the CEO what to do. I give the CEOs advice when they want it, and I participate on the boards of directors for the companies. So, I mean, it takes time, but these are like my scientific babies, you know, that are leaving the house and going off to college and hopefully, you know, getting long-term jobs or doing something. And I feel like I can help them as an advisor, but and a, you know, co-founding advisor, which is kind of what I usually make my title. And I really enjoy it. I mean, it's a lot of fun to see what can happen with them. But yeah, I don't have time to run them. And plus, you know, if I was running one of them, I couldn't be involved in the other ones. I mean, it would be a conflict of interest. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what would you think are the traits for someone who wants to, you know, go into the commercializer ideas versus someone who wants to do a PhD?
I mean, I think anybody that's doing a PhD actually could be very good at doing this. And as I mentioned, all the people that I've worked with that have done it have been PhDs. So I think PhD training is about as good as you get to, you know, be rigorous in any part of your life. So probably need to take some other classes. That's one of the things I like about being at UTD versus being in a medical school where I spent most of my life, is that these classes, like entrepreneurship classes at the graduate level, are readily available, right? You don't have to drive to another campus to take a class, which is fantastic. So I think the big thing that you have to understand is what your risk tolerance is, you know? In academia, something that I can say really bothers me about academia is that oftentimes projects continue because of momentum, not because anybody thinks it's actually the best project to work on. And you absolutely cannot do that in a company. I mean, people will see right through you and you won't go anywhere. You won't raise any money. You won't create any jobs. It'll be pointless. So, you know, you really got to understand where you would put your money and how much risk you would be willing to take by putting your money behind something. And, you know, that changes as your income changes. But I think developing risk tolerance to begin with, then, you know, understanding what your risk tolerance actually is, and then like using that to focus in on the ideas that you think are worth pursuing in a commercial venture is a really good exercise to help you think about how you can do it. And, you know, I mean, just to add on to that, just really quickly, when you start a company, something that people that are wanting to invest in you are going to look at is how much the people that founded the company actually put into it, you know? Mm-hmm. And there, it doesn't have anything to do with the actual amount that they put in, because everything is proportional, right? So if you have a PhD student who puts in $2,000, that actually the VC folk or whoever, your investor, your angel investor, whatever, probably will look at that as a huge deal because they know how much money you make. And $2,000 when you make $24,000, $25,000 a year is a big freaking deal, you know? Mm-hmm. If you have a full professor, full clinical professor who makes $300,000 a year and puts in $3,000 on a startup, they're going to be like, well, forget this. That person doesn't believe in her, you know? So
yeah, it almost sounds like a card game almost.
It is, you know? And so, I mean, that's a big part of it. What you decide to actually put behind an idea You know, you're going to get some equity just from starting the company, sure. But, you know, the company needs some money to operate when you begin. And everybody who founds a company needs to put in some money. And the amount of money that you actually put in to do it is going to tell people that come along to look at you what you think it's worth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I know that 4A Therapeutics, I believe it's based in Austin. And yeah. I want to know what makes Austin's bioentrepreneurship ecosystem unique compared to other cities in Texas, and more specifically compared to San Antonio.
Yeah, I mean, I think Austin is just a little different place from everywhere in Texas because of the kind of tech boom that's happened there and all the people that have come in from California and the East Coast that are a little bit more used to risky investment. Working in Austin in the biotech space still, though, is not like being in Boston or San Francisco or San Diego, but it's probably the better place to be in the state for a biotech startup, although, you know, Dallas and Houston are probably close behind. The nice thing also about Austin is that you do kind of have this constant influx of people that are making a lot of money in the software industry, you know, and a lot of them are looking for new types of investment to come after. So it's a good place to talk to people. San Antonio, I imagine, is a little bit like it was for us in Tucson. You know, San Antonio and Tucson are relatively the same sizes in terms of population, but they just don't have like the investment background that some of the other cities have in Texas. And geography does play a big role. You know, I mean, we really wanted to start a company in Arizona. We in fact would have liked to have licensed this technology that's behind Parmedics that we just licensed it wasn't even a couple months ago. It was last month. We would have liked to have done that in like 2011, and we just never could get it done. And the reason we could never get it done is we couldn't find anybody to work with on the business side there. And geography does make a big difference, but don't let it hinder your dreams to do something like that too much. You know, I mean, it's increasingly easy to connect to the right people, and Texas is a really good place to be in startup ventures in just about any industry. I won't say what I think about Arizona. It's not as good a place to be as Texas. I just think San Antonio is a little bit, probably a little bit behind compared to the other big cities in Texas.
Yeah, it seems like Texas is becoming very big in this ecosystem or just the investment landscape in general.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know what? What I would say is probably would be beneficial for y'all down in San Antonio once we can actually, you know, travel and hold in-person events again to try to do some stuff with the Dell Medical Center up at UT, because they were putting together some good programming and stuff before COVID hit.
I actually want to know if you would like to have any last comment or remarks before we sign off.
I don't, but thank you guys very much for what you're doing. I think it's great that you're doing this, number one, and thanks for inviting me to be on your podcast.
All right.
Thanks, y'all.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Take care.
Have a good holiday. Bye.
You too. Happy holidays. Bye. If you were unsure about which path to take, I hope this conversation with Dr. Price has shown you that you don't have to choose between academia and industry. You can do both.